I thought I'd follow this afternoon from a thread that Carol brought in this morning. She was speaking about motivations and why we do what we do, and getting familiar with that, knowing something about that, being aware of that. And she did say, you know, this isn't as a big project, and that it bears repeating. That bears repeating over and over again. What we describe as what sound like instructions, you know, you could notice this, or you can pay attention to that. Sayadaw often says that it doesn't have to be something to do, it's just something that we might become aware of. So these motivations, you know, the motivation for experience when we get up to shift our posture or get a drink of water, those motivations are happening. It's not that we have to make them happen. They're already happening, and awareness can reveal what's already happening. It's almost more of a curiosity or an inclining or an interest in, gee, I wonder if I might be able to see these motivations, might be able to get familiar with how these intentions work. But then you don't have to go looking. You don't have to go looking for it. And as I said, I think a day or two ago, you know, just this conversation, I don't remember if I said this in the hall or in the groups, just this conversation, just talking about becoming aware of these things is a condition that may support the mindfulness to be able to see it, to be able to meet it, to recognize it. So motivations, the underlying reasons why we act, they shape the unfolding of our experience. Kind of the engine of how our experience unfolds, these motivations. Sometimes in simple ways, such as just experiencing the body becoming thirsty after sitting for a long time, experiencing perhaps the unpleasantness of that, and an intention arises to alleviate that thirst, and the body moves. So sometimes they're simple like that. Sometimes they're more complex. They're more complexes of emotions and moods that motivate us. So these motivations, Buddha talked about intentions, the word. He often talked about noticing how intention works, intention motivating action, being a very crucial part of how karma unfolds, how our lives are moved in the direction either of more struggle, more stress, or more ease and peace in our lives. If our motivations, our intentions are rooted in greed, aversion, delusion, it tends to shape suffering. If our motivations are rooted in non-greed, non-aversion, non-delusion, wholesome qualities of love, wisdom, generosity, compassion. These are also mind states. They're also motivations that can shape our experience. They shape actions. That it's not just our greed and aversion that shape what we do. It's also love and wisdom, patience, joy, will shape our experience. So these are all what the Buddha called mental formations. mind states that have a intentional component to them, an aspect of action, of motivating action. So mental, there are many, many mental formations. The Pali word for this is sankhara. And it is a very big part of our experience. It includes all of what we would call emotions, including the reactive as well as the wholesome. So frustration, anger, greed, confusion, you know, all of those kind of states in the mind, as well as love and compassion. So the whole emotional terrain falls into this, under this word of sankhara or mental formation. Volitional formation, another translation. Fabrication is the translation that Thanissaro Bhikkhu uses. They all have the translations all include some kind of constructing nature. Formations, form, forming, fabrications, fabricating. So it's active. These mind states are active. So these formations, these mind states include these emotional terrain, but it also includes things that we wouldn't consider emotions, like views and beliefs, agendas. It includes other states of mind that we wouldn't call emotion, like concentration and mindfulness. So this is a really big part of what goes on in our mind. And we can begin to get familiar with these mental formations. One way that Sayadaw encourages us to go about getting familiar with these, and again, not as a project, but more as something that can be noticed. He encourages us to get to know them as activities, not just as something, as a thing, but as activities. He says, get to know the job description of these mind states. What do they do? So this is really pointing to the active nature of these, the shaping nature of these states of mind, how they influence our experience, how they influence not only our choices, but what we experience, and also how it influences what's happening outside of us. So I love that that encouragement to get to know the job description. It takes it, it kind of points out that these activities in our mind are just that, they're activities. So they shape our experience. How do they shape our experience? Why is it useful to get to know them as job descriptions or as activities? It is partly because it points out to explore this aspect of our experience from the perspective of how they function in our minds. So what do they do? What is their job? It points to them as processes of mind. We see them as processes rather than who we are. We see them as activities. So we might, for example, see, and we see that each of these job descriptions, as we explore and experience when a particular mind state is arising, we get to know how does it function. And then we see a different mind state arising and we see how does that one function. We see that the whole of our experience is shaped in different ways depending on what is arising in the mind. And we see, for instance, that it might be the job of greed to go out and look for things to be attached to find pleasant things, and to hold on to it, to stick to it. And that is the job of greed. That's what greed does when it's arising in the mind. It's not personal. It does it for all of us. That's the nature of greed. So seeing these mind states, these experiences that happen, the motivations, the processes of mind as activities helps us to see the conditioned nature of our experience. Helps us potentially to disidentify with them, to stop taking ownership of them as I or me or mine. They're just processes doing their job. So the Buddha spoke in a kind of a general way about, he didn't use this word job description in the suttas, but he did talk about mental formations as an activity. And he described what this activity of mental formations does. And so in a kind of a general way, he described the general nature of the job of mental formations. And he pointed to these mental formations as being basically shapers of experience, of all experience, of all of our experience. They shape how we feel, how we perceive. They shape what we know, what we take in. They shape how our body is. And they shape our intentions and actions. Some of you who are familiar with some of the Buddhist teachings may recognize in what I just said, the list of the five aggregates. I'll just offer briefly what these five are. I'm not gonna offer a teaching of it right now, but just a brief description of these five aggregates. There are five processes of body and mind that the Buddha kind of highlighted as the processes of human experience. And he actually encouraged us to look at our human experience and notice that it falls within these five aggregates. Whatever we notice, whatever we see arising as conditioned experience, is one of these five aggregates. It's body, it's physical experience, form, both internal and external form. It's this physicality is one of these processes. The other four processes are mental processes. So they're the process of feeling, whether experience is pleasant, unpleasant, or neither pleasant nor unpleasant. It's the process of perceiving, the recognizing of experience. As we look around and look in our world, we recognize objects in the world. We recognize bookcases and windows and trees. And we recognize light. So we recognize, there's perception. We notice and know what we are experiencing. A lot based on prior experience, prior knowledge. This is another aspect of our experience, the perceiving process of experience. Then there's mental formation, these whole terrain of mind states that have an intentional component to them, or an active component to them. Intention is a funny word. Sometimes when we hear that word intention, we think consciously intending. We think that it would mean that I'm consciously intending, but these mental formations have their own intention. So when greed arises, it intends to stick to things. We don't have to be involved in that. It will do that. So these mental formations have this volitional or intentional component to it, with intention just meaning this activity to do, this movement to do or to engage. And then the fifth aggregate is consciousness, is just this a bare knowing of experience. And so these five processes are kind of interwoven in any moment of experience. These five processes are at work, helping us to navigate our world. We experience a sight, and the because we've got the eye, which is form, got this eye, we've got this form that is very sensitive and it receives light. There's contact, and that's consciousness begins. So there's consciousness, and with consciousness, there's feeling and perception. There's a feeling. It's pleasant, unpleasant. It's neutral. Something seen is pleasant, unpleasant, neutral. It's recognized as being something, a tree, or maybe more simple. It might just be recognized as green or brown. And then there can be emotions or moods or feelings that arise with that, you know, potentially seeing a tree. It's kind of connecting to some tree that we sat under when we were a kid, when it was just such a lovely day, and we have this just lovely emotional tone response that arises in connection to seeing that tree. So this in any moment, these five aggregates are at work, helping us to receive, process, navigate our world. So in terms of the Buddha's describing mental formations in the context of these five aggregates, and I'm going to read a translation that's from Tanisaro Bhikkhu that uses the word fabrication instead of volitional formation. I like this translation works for me. So somebody's asking the Buddha, why are they called fabrications? And he says, because they fabricate fabricated things. That's why they're called fabrications. What do they fabricate? They fabricate form as a fabricated thing. They fabricate feeling as a fabricated thing. They fabricate perception as a fabricated thing. They fabricate fabrications as a fabricated thing. And they fabricate consciousness as a fabricated thing. Essentially, he's saying the job description of fabrications is to fabricate the aggregates, to fabricate experience. The general job description of mental formations is the fabrication of the entirety of our experience. That's kind of mind-blowing when you think about it. And so let's just, you know, take an example. That's in the abstract, right? That's just the abstract. Fabrications in general shape the aggregates. But let's look at, how about aversion? And from Saito Utejaniya's perspective. So what's the job description of aversion? In my own experience, you know, looking at this myself, you know, the kind of basic function, the basic job of aversion is it wants to separate me from something. That's the basic job description. Different flavors of aversion may have different qualities of that separation. You know, the anger flavor may have an annihilation, wanting to, you know, wanting to separate by annihilating something, by destroying it. A fear may have that separating quality, being a, you know, pull away. But that's the basic, kind of the basic function of aversion, to separate. And there's a belief in there, so a kind of another aspect of the aversion is that it believes that the separation is going to bring us happiness, going to make us feel better in some way. And this is all from my own exploration, these three that I'm naming now. This is kind of the way in looking at aversion over and over again, which I have done a lot of. These three pieces, the aversion, the nature of aversion is to separate. It believes that separation is going to make me happy in some way. And it orients the mind, so it orients consciousness to looking for things to separate from. If we look at that's the perspective, you know, the exploration around looking at the job description. But now let's look at it from the Buddhist perspective of, you know, how does it shape the aggregates? How does this aversion shape the aggregates? Let's look at anger as a form of aversion. So how does anger shape our physical experience? Anger shapes it may actually distort the face. It actually physically distort the face when there's anger arising. It can create internal sensations of pressure and heat. It may encourage a kind of a tensing of muscles. This is a way that anger shapes form. Feeling, in my experience, feeling usually becomes unpleasant with anger. The feeling of anger itself is unpleasant, and often anger is oriented around something that is unpleasant, so there's a lot of unpleasantness in there. Although I have noticed, interestingly, in my exploration of anger, really seeing what's the effect of anger on the system, that's essentially the question. Curiosity, again, not to look at or try to figure out this, but on one retreat, I was seeing a lot of anger, and it's like, wow, I got a lot of opportunity to look at this. So let's see, you know, what's going on here? And I was very curious about it because it was so unpleasant, you know, but there was some kind of drive towards the anger, some kind of like impulse. The mind just wanted to pick up that anger. It's like, what on earth is the mind getting out of this? So that was curiosity. There was curiosity there. And just over time, and as Carol was talking about, the steady awareness revealing this unfolding conditioning, the steady awareness over the course of that retreat began to reveal more and more, until at one moment, I was present right as the anger began, just the beginning arising of that anger. And in that moment, the experience was pleasant. It felt powerful, it felt strong, it felt, you know, really potent in a way. There was just a moment of real, like, yes, I know. It was like that becoming of something. Very quickly, within a split second, it turned into really unpleasant experience. But for a split second, it was like, yes, this is the direction. I know how to make you feel like you know what you need to do here. That, and it was like, wow, that was the hook. That's the hook. The mind felt like the entire thing is worth it because of that split second. And it bought in that moment to the perspective or view, belief that anger had, that I know the way to make you happy, that believing separation will bring happiness. I know the way. That That is what the mind was hooked to. It was kind of startling. So I said, generally, you know, anger shapes unpleasant experience, but the hook in that case was that pleasant feeling of power, of control. So sometimes there might be pleasant experience in there. How does anger shape perception? Perception, how we recognize things. When we have anger in the mind, it's like a lens. So this whole shaping experience is like the experience of this mind state is a filter on our experience. And so when there's anger in the mind, we basically tend to perceive experience through that filter. We may mistakenly perceive things with assumptions that are built into that anger. So for instance, we might see somebody else looking at us with a kind of a quizzical look on their face, and we think that they are plotting against us because of that filter of anger. And all that they're thinking about is their lunch yesterday. You know, we don't know what they're thinking about. So the anger shapes how we perceive experience. And our consciousness, what we actually take in, what our consciousness lets in, is also shaped by that anger. We may see things, and this is a very strong tendency in our mental formations. We see things that will confirm the views, the beliefs, the biases that are embedded in that mental formation. We will tend to the consciousness will tend to search out and gravitate towards those things that confirm that. So we become conscious of certain things and not conscious of other things based on that filter. So the exploration of the job description of this was pretty detailed what I described, and it is things that I have noticed in my own practice, but rarely all at once. You know, it's over the course of looking at anger, of aversion, over the years that I've seen these variety of things, you may see one little piece in one moment. It's not like you have to think, okay, how is anger shaping the body right now? But in a moment, like being with anger, knowing, aware of anger with this curiosity of what's the job description of anger? How's it shaping experience? One or the other of these pieces may be clear. You may learn something about the nature of this mind state. Oh, the other piece, I forgot one piece about the shaping in the aggregate. So not only do the mental formations shape the other four aggregates, so mental anger, for instance, anger shapes the body, the feeling, the perceptions, what we take in, the consciousness. Anger also tends to shape more anger. It shapes further mental formation in the direction of this arising mental formation. So anger tends to shape more anger, tends to construct more anger. So there can be this kind of curiosity, this curiosity about the job description helps us not only to see the processes, but also to see the impact that these mind states have on our experience. So we feel the effect that anger has on us. As I said, you know, I saw pretty quickly how painful anger was. That actually was a learning, you know, that was an early learning in my practice. Looking at anger was my very first meditation practice. It was a daily life practice, and I was just wanting to know when anger arose and to be mindful of it. And that was about all that I was trying to do. And almost one of the first things I noticed when I noticed the anger was, wow, this hurts. This is unpleasant. This is painful. You'd think that this would be obvious, you know, and it is once you start looking at the experience. But the other piece very quickly I saw was that in the exploration of just being with anger, noticing little bits and pieces here and there, was that a belief in the mind that this anger was going to make the person I was angry at miserable, that it was going to make them feel miserable or something. And so that was like, that was where my mind was oriented. It wasn't actually noticing that I was feeling miserable first. Fortunately, in this particular case, I was in the Peace Corps and I was like 7,000 miles away from the person I was angry with. And so it quickly became kind of clear that no, the person wasn't experiencing anything based on this anger, but I was miserable. So the exploration of seeing the effect of these mind states, this is part of how wise mindfulness works. It's obvious when we look at it, but as I saw this, I could see, wow, you know, the mind is like willing to forego ease and peace here and now because it thinks it wants to make somebody else be miserable. I mean, just that. I mean, that's kind of an odd thing in the mind too, you know, that seeing how that state of mind is constructing, wanting somebody else to hurt, that also was a kind of an insight or a recognition. It's like the thing that arose in my mind was like, oh my gosh, this is where war comes from. You know, it was not the kind of anger that I was actually going to go off and physically hurt somebody, but it had that quality in the mind of wanting somebody else to suffer. And I could see that, you know, that has an effect in the world. That can have an effect in the world. So we can be curious about the job descriptions of our mind states, including the wholesome ones. The wholesome qualities of mind also have job descriptions, also affect and shape our experience. And what we quickly see, the one of the powers of seeing with mindfulness the wholesome qualities, unlike the unwholesome qualities, most of the wholesome qualities have a very a light and connected, expansive kind of feeling to them. It's clear in the moment of experiencing aversion, this is not the way to happiness. It is clear in the moment of experiencing love, not attached love, but that the metta, the quality of care and connection, that this is a wholesome state, that this is heading in the direction of well-being. And so this exploration around the job descriptions is as important with our, Carol said this, you know, it's like we may just like when ease is happening, just go, oh yeah, that's great. Get to know the job description of love, of compassion, of wisdom. Get to know those states. Mindfulness is an amazing quality. Mindfulness too is a mental formation. We're encouraging you to get to know the experience of being aware. What is the experience of wise mindfulness? What is the experience of mindfulness with wise view. So you get, as we get to know that, you know, it doesn't have the emotional tone to it necessarily, but the experience when we have that wise mindfulness, the system understands this is helpful. Partly because we see that all those shifts we've been talking about, the insight, the seeing into, the shift between being caught by something, being caught by some reactivity, and having that wise mindfulness with that reactivity. That shift, that experience of knowing, oh yes, this is being aware with wisdom of that experience. Our system understands that as supportive, as helpful. There was a question in the submitted in advance. And Carol responded to much of it this morning, but there's a piece of it that I wanted to just highlight. You've talked about keeping a contact with awareness, even when nearly falling over with sleepiness. Can you talk about the benefit of this? Did you dispel the torpor and awaken in some state gratifying to a yogi? With a little smiley face there. So, whether or not the sleepiness is dispelled, being aware of sleepiness with that mind that knows it, this is sleepiness happening. Just as Carol was talking about this morning. Being aware. The wholesome mind state of mindfulness and wisdom are present. That's the benefit. You're cultivating that state of mind. The shift from being involved in a hindrance to being aware with wisdom. The hindrance no longer has the upper hand. The hindrance is no longer being cultivated. What's being cultivated is mindfulness and wisdom. That mind state, and that's a great time to get to know the job description of mindfulness and wisdom. You see that shift, you understand that mindfulness and wisdom have this function in our minds. When mindfulness and wisdom are present, they have the simultaneous. So let's just talk again about looking at something like anger. If we're observing anger with that mindfulness and wisdom, not only are mindfulness and wisdom being cultivated, so the wholesome qualities are being cultivated and are strengthening, but also in that exploration, the unwholesome quality of the reactivity is weakening, partly because we see what it's like to have that reactivity happening. So being with anger, feeling the pain of that, feeling the suffering that comes here and now, you know, we feel that. It's, you know, we feel with mindfulness and wisdom, we still feel the pain of that reactivity. We just know there's some separation, there's some distance, there's some ability to know it and not be caught in it. So that learning that's happening around the anger there, or whatever reactivity is happening, is creating the conditions for that reactivity to arise less frequently in the future. Because the system is beginning to learn, that way lies suffering. So at the same time as we're looking at a reactive emotion, not only are the wholesome qualities of mindfulness and wisdom, and perhaps other qualities too, like patience, like kindness to ourselves for not being engaged in that, but being willing to observe it. Those wholesome qualities are being cultivated. And at the same time, the mind is understanding this reactive state is not helpful. And the wisdom is starting to learn how to let go of it. So it gets weaker. It's not like immediately it necessarily goes poof and vanishes, but it gets weaker. So simultaneously, wise mindfulness creates the conditions to strengthen the wholesome and diminish the unwholesome. That's why we bring wise mindfulness to the hindrances. And it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter what's happening. Really, really, it doesn't matter. One last piece around the aggregates and mindfulness. This kind of came up earlier today in one of the groups. Mindfulness is, as a mental formation, mindfulness is sometimes there and sometimes not there. Sometimes it's arising, sometimes it's not arising. We know this. Sometimes mindfulness is not happening. We're lost in thought, involved in everything, caught by something. The five aggregates are processes that are going on all the time. They don't stop. They're arising every moment, arising and passing, every moment. Consciousness, feeling, perception, arising, passing. Consciousness, feeling, perception, along with some mental formation and some bodily experience. They're just coming and going every single moment, all the time. Sometimes mindfulness will be arising with that. When it is, the job of mindfulness is to reflect those aggregates, to know, to bring awareness to those aggregates. So this understanding for me has been helpful, just articulating this to myself in my mind, that the job of mindfulness isn't to construct something. I don't have to find something to pay attention to. As soon as mindfulness arises, the five aggregates are already there. They've been there. They've been happening. The five aggregates tumble along all the time. You know, when mindfulness returns, sometimes we can be aware of what was going on before. We can remember what was going on before. And Sayadaw will often say, why is that? Why is it that we can remember when mindfulness arises that what we were doing in the last 5 minutes? He said it's because perception and feeling were doing their job. Perception, feeling, and consciousness were doing their job. The whole unfolding of our experience is just this tumbling on of these processes. Mindfulness arises with that sometime, and the job of mindfulness is just to reflect that. In the moment of waking up, there's something already taking place. No need to find anything. It's there already. Awareness is back. Aware again. Already aware of something. Just what's obvious. So in a way, that was a kind of a repeat of what Carol said, but just different words. We've been saying, we keep saying the same thing over and over again. That's kind of what we do. So there are a few minutes. Why don't we break the recording?